Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the first of a special series of banter podcasts from Web Summit 2015 at Dublin's RDS. Our first interview is with Jamie Heaslip, the Leinster and Ireland rugby player, tech investor and pub and restaurant co-owner. As befits a man with so many hats, Jamie had much to talk about, including the recent Rugby World Cup, his view on pundits, the future of rugby, the use of data and metrics in the game, rugby's economic success and the road ahead for young players. We're here with Web Summit and the RDS in Dublin, and we're joined by someone who knows all about Dublin 4 because he works nearby. We're joined by rugby player Jamie Heaslip. Jamie, can we start by leaving the rugby aside for a start, right? Let's leave the rugby aside for a start. What are you doing here at Web Summit?
What am I doing here? Like most people, I'm here to see others speak. I'm here to try and meet some pretty interesting people and kind of widen my network, I suppose. But, you know, I'm an angel investor, an entrepreneur off the field, and you know, I've a couple of different companies that are game changers, disruptors, if you want to call them, and that's why I am here.
Yeah, let's talk about, like, you know, that idea of kind of like companies being disruptive, I mean, companies kind of moving into spaces and changing things around. You've invested in a few media companies. You've invested with Niall Harbison in Love in Dublin. You've also got the Bar. You're working with like Joe Macken in terms of Bear, and you've also got the Bridge down the road here. You know, and like, you know, what can, like, in those particular traditional businesses? Let's leave Niall and Love in Dublin aside, but like in the restaurant business, the bar business, is there elements of disruption there?
Well, not as much, I suppose. In one way, yes. You know, we saw an opportunity that a prime pub that had been undervalued and probably underused over the last 10 years, 15 years maybe. And we were in a position, you know, the market was in our favor in terms of the asset itself. But then we looked around and, you know, every pub and club around Ireland, you know, is very good to rugby players. They kind of go hand in hand after a good win or after a bad loss to kind of drown your sorrows. But, you know, we kind of said they get a lot of traction off the back of players going there and getting associated with players or whatever. So we said, you know, let's really test it.
Yeah.
And let's disrupt the market. And we kind of looked around, you know, I see different player, like the only player I knew in Ireland otherwise, there's two of them, was Claw and Flad and Limerick who did it and had success, you know what I mean, doing it. And so
their product is very traditional though, you know. It's like,
no, it is, but what I mean is they definitely leveraged the start of it off their name, you know what I mean, and the fact that players are going in there became the rugby pub. And we were kind of going, well, here we go, four players, pub 200-300 metres from where the RDS is, 500 metres from the Aviva Stadium.
Yeah.
It was a no-brainer, you know what I mean? And we just said, right, let's get in and mess up that market with, you know, the guys across the road are great. Yeah, very different pub to us, like, you know, Mary Max and that. But, you know, we said, right, there's plenty to go around. Let's get in there and mix it up.
It's something that I've kind of noticed on your Twitter feed, Jamie. You're very good at kind of posting links to articles which are showing things where players take power, take ownership of their own brands. You were on this morning about the Players Tribune. You kind of like linked to that. Do you think that's something that's kind of like mean changed in the last couple of years? Players realizing, you know, the currency of their own names and the fact that, like, it definitely strikes me rugby more than anything else. That players seem to realize the value of their own brands.
I think rugby's probably most current because of the World Cup that's just gone on. I mean, I think they said it's going to be the first Rugby World Cup that is going to be €1 billion in revenue, 2.5 million through the gates of games. Like, they're just smashing numbers out of the park all over the place, and their digital presence, I've saved myself reading up on that because they've smashed that out of the park. But I think it's a game, because it's still relatively young, it's 20 years professional, and you know, brands are trying to figure out how to use it, and the game itself is trying to figure out how to best use their impact on society, I suppose, or their leverage that they have with corporate brands and the people that go to their games. And it's only going to keep growing.
But it strikes me as well, though, that players are an awful lot more savvy. That sometimes the players are a lot more savvy than the lads in the Blazers, you know, into realizing, you know, the value of what they've got here, because you're on social media, you see what's going on there, you're young, you're out in the field, you're in the Bridge or Bear, and you see what's going on, you see the value of the name.
Well, you do see the value in it, and you have to, because you know the clubs, the countries, you know, they're leveraging their brand and your association with it for you know, corporate sponsorship essentially, or for ticket sales or for event sales, you know what I mean? So you've got to have a bit of sense about it, you know, but some of the people, more experienced people of the game, let's say, they don't know professional rugby.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why there's a bit of a... it's gotten better over the last couple of years in terms of the steps that have been taken to kind of upskill people and or put people in place that do have experience in it. And it's getting better in the game. And I think you've seen that through the expansion and growth of both my club, Leinster, Ireland as well, and their presence, and the presence of what the Rugby World Cup was.
Mm.
It's just interesting. I mean, you look at the Players Tribune, it's just, you know, that's a great disruptor where the players have actually taken ownership of the content, because content is key going forward. I mean, you see it with Netflix, you see it with YouTube, you see it with all these different forms of media that you can watch anything. You can listen to this anytime you want to. This isn't live, you know what I mean? But the real things that people like, sports is one of the few things left that people actually tune in live for.
Yeah.
Because the way the world's so connected, you're going to hear the results.
Yeah.
2 minutes later.
Yeah.
And if you haven't watched it live, then it's just not the same experience. So
yeah.
I think that's why sport is really, both the players and the associations are realizing that kind of strength that they have there, that asset that they have.
And you know, you can also see as well, I mean, new or smarter people moving in as well and doing the backroom deals. I mean, Damien Donohue is your boy, you know,
yep.
He's your manager. And like, I mean, someone like him as well, given his background, given how he's got the music side, like down pat, like me, he also did a whole like stuff with the cricket as well.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, are there more people like him moving in, or is it the case that the old school are still around?
Ah, there's you know, there's some people there, all right, from the old school, but I think their ways there and their models of thinking are going to be tested going forward. As the game is going to naturally expand, it's going to have to expand and scale up in order for it to be sustainable. And I think those ideas are going to be. Their way is going to be challenged, and that's just the way of any corner market. The market just changed, the field, the goalposts change, and you've got to adapt.
Yeah, it's very interesting you talked there about scale, Jamie, because I mean, one of the things that kind of stood out for me at the Rugby World Cup, you know, was the Japanese game against South Africa, and the way they bashed them off the field, and you know, and the great lift it gave, and that was a real publicity thing. Where else do you think scale can come? I mean, are there other markets that haven't been tapped yet?
Ah, there's plenty of markets, but I think with the fact that sevens is now an Olympic sport is going to open up the door massively. I mean, I know I was just in New York last week and talking to a couple of people there in the East Coast that a couple of colleges are making rugby varsity, so they're getting that that money coming in from the NCAA, is that right?
Yes, right, yeah.
You know, and that's going to be a bit of a game changer. Now, granted, main focus on sevens because it's an Olympic sport, but I think that's naturally going to grow the interest in the sport over there, and I think they can be a sleeping giant. Now, we've all learned from MLS that you have to sink 15 years worth of money into it to grow, but you know, now it's getting some foothold, it's getting some real gain. Other emerging markets, well, we've seen that, you know, Eastern Europe has really come to the fore. You've seen you know, Japan being the one that probably kind of caught everyone's attention during the World Cup as well, but you know, the list goes on and on and on in terms of the potential of it. You know, South America as well, you saw, who was it, Argentina obviously beat us. They're going to have a Super 15 franchise in there now as well, which is going to expand the game into there and just open up more markets, and the more markets the better, because the more money that comes in, the more potential there is there to do things and to grow the game and have more actual professional clubs and more money to go around, so that it's you can sustain that.
But do you reckon though that there's going to come a time when the kind of like, I mean, supposed to, the southern hemisphere kind of like dominance is going to be challenged, you know? I mean, it struck me as kind of like, you know, interesting the fact that the semi-finalists were all southern hemisphere times this round. It's a bit like Kilkenny and Tipperary and Cork in Hurling, you know?
They were, but I mean, you look at the quarterfinals, it was a 50-50 split, I think. Wales, Scotland, France, Ireland. Yeah, I had to double check myself there. But yeah, it was a 50-50 split. We could have won our game. Very hard to come back from 17-0 down, but we nearly did it. So, Scotland nearly won their game. Wales had a good shout as well, I thought. And, you know, France, I think, were the ones that, the favourites won. New Zealand are playing some amazing rugby, have done over the last 4 years. But I think people are getting very, very carried away with that assumption that there's a dominance from the southern hemisphere. You know, on any given day, like Japan showed, it's all about the team that makes the least amount of mistakes. On our day, we made more mistakes in Argentina than they won, you know what I mean? Same for, you could probably argue the same for all the other games, the way they went.
How, like, I mean, you were part of the Rugby World Cup, like, crew, the whole, like, me up to kind of, like, mean the quarterfinals. As a player and as an observer, like, how did it go? I mean, I'm curious about this in a kind of a soft power way, because, I mean, if you look at the fact that Ireland is trying to host a future Rugby World Cup, and you look at the kind of, like, the kerfuffle at the moment around Web Summit leaving and going down to Lisbon, and, like, the way it's kind of, like, I mean, countries and cities, can benefit from bringing in things like this.
Huge money. I mean, I from being a local businessman in this area alone, like, and having a venue in town as well, the inflow of business in this week alone. Last year, this was our biggest week of business in the pub.
Really? Even with all the matches?
It was our biggest week, hands down, by a long shot. And for someone like, for the Web Summit to move is unfortunate. But these things happen, like injuries happen. You just deal with it, you move on with it. In terms of the bid with the World Cup, I mean, I think I was reading a great article, just giving me all the insights. You know, there's 2.5 million people went through the gates for the Rugby Cup. You know, I was obviously at the Ireland games, and you know, we set a world record at one of the games. We sold out Wembley for an Ireland game against Romania. You know what I mean?
That's in Sheeran territory.
It's mental. Yeah. You know what I mean? Then we sold out the Cardiff Millennium Stadium twice, and like I would say 80% were Irish. It was like electric atmosphere. And there was probably another 100,000 people out in the street, Irish people out in the streets. It was mental stuff. And then when you look at the actual viewership, like TV3 made a very, very smart move and bought the rights. And they got, I think they had just over 1 million viewers for the France game.
Yeah.
They had just under 1 million viewers for the quarterfinal. Their advertising, the advertisers around it, like I think it was Air and ESB.
ESB, yeah.
Like, they're talking about they had something like a million to 1.2 million impressions off the back of it. So what I mean is that there's a massive hunger there from the Irish public for a competition to come here. And like, we're sports mad. Imagine like lads playing down in Thomond or Musgrave or in one of the GAA grounds in Croke Park. Like, imagine playing in front in Croke Park, World Cup game in Croke Park. It'd be unreal, and the support around it would make the competition amazing. The time zone, obviously, for maybe the American market on the West Coast, or the time zone is perfect in terms of viewership for the competition, and it would shed it in such an amazing. Like, I hope to God we get that bid. I think it'd be amazing, and for the economy, like, I don't even want to know what the boost to the economy would be that year alone.
Yeah. I'm curious there, you said there about like being TV3, and they were one of the big winners when they came this year, you know. They also kind of freshened up the approach to rugby and rugby coverage, you know. In terms of like mean pundits, in terms of like mean analysis and things like that. Do you think, you know, the rugby suffers in some ways from kind of like an old mind mentality?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, 100%. I think there was and is some guys that are just removed from the game for a long time. I'm not saying their opinion isn't valued. I just don't think they're up to date on how the game is played and what goes into the game now.
Because it has
detail. But the guys that have come out of the game recently, the last like 4 or 5 years, have been really, really good in educating the public and giving them those little nuggets and insights into the game, you know, and giving them tidbits so that when they're in the bridge having a pint, they're able to go like, well, actually, you know, Shane Horgan said this, you know what I mean? And because of X, Y, and Z, and this will happen on the field, as opposed to, well, I feel like there's just some cowboys out there.
Cowboys, that's a good way to put it. But like, you know, it has changed. And there's also something as well. I mean, like, Jamie, the players are younger, and dealing with a younger mindset is very hard to do. And just that's quite hard to do, isn't it?
Well, that's good. You know, players are coming out of school 17, 18, going straight into academy. Very few of them go, the odd one goes straight pro. That happens rarely. But like, when they're in the academy, they're training just as much as you would as a professional. Like, just as much. And you get worried that they get caught up in a little bubble. Some of them don't finish college. Some of them try and put it out over numerous years. And A, that they miss out in the college years. You're not, when you go into college 17, 18, you're not the same person when you come out at 21, 22. I know I wasn't anyway. You know, you learn a lot, you grow a lot. And so these people kind of miss out on that kind of important time in your life, I think. And also, some of them just, you know, they scrap college and they just kind of think rugby's going to be the be all and end all, but like it's a harsh business. Once you're once you're not at a certain standard, you get spat out at the end, and that's why I look at avenues and different things off the field. So we call it the afterlife post rugby. So that I'm prepared for it, and I have things there that I can keep my head above water.
Mm. But I mean, you're still in the game, you know. You signed up here till 2017.
Yeah.
Are you tempted by moving abroad again?
Oh, am I tempted?
Yeah.
I haven't even I think a player should always keep their options open. In terms of, when it comes to that contract, I think you're very foolish just not to, in general, not to see what your other options are. And then it's not just, the monetary value. There's a lot of intangible things that you have to weigh up in terms of what you want from it, the lifestyle you want, where you are in your life, and where you want to kind of go. Then that's when you weigh all that stuff. But you need choices to make to weigh it up. You can't just have one on your table.
Because, obviously at the moment, there was talk this morning of Simon Zeebo kind of moving abroad, and obviously Johnny Sexton's been abroad as well. You talk to these players as well. Does that have a big bearing as well, their experiences and what they kind of found and what they liked or disliked?
Yeah, but different people are different strokes for different folks. Some guys are homebred, some guys aren't. Some guys are willing to travel. I've traveled all my life, born in Israel. I've lived in Cyprus, I've lived in Croatia, I lived in Belgium, and I'm from Nice, but I've been living in Dublin. You kind of home is where the heart is, so you make your own home, wherever you want to be. If you want to be in a place, you'll enjoy it. If you go there and you don't really want to be there, I think you're always going to be saying what if and looking back, and that's just wasted energy and no good for anyone.
Yeah, bringing it back to kind of like, so that's why we're here. And again, final couple of questions, Jimmy. Thank you very much for taking the time to come along to us. I suppose we're here at a kind of tech conference, and when it comes to kind of like a sport and tech, I sat through a presentation this morning, a bizarre presentation on virtual reality headsets when it comes to kind of viewing sports.
I want to do the VR thing. I saw Facebook have it or something, they
Facebook have it around the corner from us here. Yeah. But over in the sports stage earlier on, there was someone doing it. I was kind of looking at this thing, kind of going like, "Jeez, I don't know." And again, you linked to an article recently, enough again, where someone watched an NBA game.
Yeah.
And their big takeaway from you using VR when it came to an NBA game was, "I didn't puke." So I mean, how far away are we from that kind of thing?
I don't know. I've never used it. You see, but I like that article because at least they're trying to broaden that experience, that a kind of experiential event. For people, you could do a virtual reality world, but actually trying to be there and watch a game or I saw a real cool one they were doing with, I think English rugby did it, where you put the VR set and you went through a training session with them. Yeah.
Mm.
And then the All Blacks did it, what it's like to face the haka and what it's like to be doing the haka with the virtual reality. And walk around it.
That's fascinating because that's an advanced form of sports psychology in a way.
I didn't even think of that angle. I was thinking more the fan engagement and how to get that another touch point with the fan and give them another another feeling from the game.
Just in terms of tech, in terms of the rugby playing side of things as well. Has the amount of tech been used in rugby in terms of strength, conditioning, monitoring, metrics and all that? Is that going up all the time? What's been the most interesting thing that you've come across late in that field?
I one of my first ever investments was in Kitman Labs, which is a really neat piece of kind of motion capturing device and also sucks in all the data from the GPS and from your physios and your doctors and all that kind of stuff, and helps you manage the workload for athletes so that you can have them peaking at the right time. So at every weekend, obviously at the game, you want them peaking. And then obviously you go peaks and troughs through your season in terms of you want to peak, let's say, coming into Europe. So you build all the way up to Europe, and then you might have to come back down because it's hard to stay up at the top the whole time in anything. You can't have your foot in the accelerator the whole time. So that company, we were going great guns. We're in all professional sports in America now, as well as rugby and soccer here, and that has helped us reduce the injury profile of teams. I think on average by something like 30%. I think that's what it was when we first started using it. And at the end of the day, once you have, there's a correlation between having all your best players available and your return on success. But the big thing what data does, I think, is just gives you black and white answers, gives you feedback, gives you something concrete, not a feeling, anything like that.
Do players obsess on that kind of data?
No, but they definitely know that the markers that it gives you. You know, each player chooses different markers that's to them. Like for me, when I look at a game, when I see the data report come back from, I'm interested in the volume I ran and my high speed meters, my top speed, and the number of accelerations, because that kind of tells me how far I ran, obviously, in the game, but like my ratio of how far I ran versus like how fast I ran that, you know what I mean? Then the number of accelerations, for me, it's kind of more like how many times I just got up off the ground and got going again, you know, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. And then top speed is just, you want to be hitting good speeds in the game. So they're my markers, you know what I mean? Different players have different markers, and it just gives you something tangible to work with. That you need it's like having your weekly review. Okay, you hit these targets. Okay, how can I better myself on that?
Great. Okay, Jamie, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks a million to Jamie for his time, and to Mary, Elder, Mike, and all of the Web Summit media team for their help facilitating this series of interviews. This podcast was recorded and produced by Garrett Hines, and thanks to Erica and Leon for Bodytonic for their assistance. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Please remember to check out our other podcasts on Web Summit 2015, and of course our regular series of Banter podcasts. You can find these and details of all upcoming Banter events at thisisbanter.com. We'll talk to you soon.